Use. Couple of quick announcements for the benefit of the committee. We were scheduled on Thursday to hear a couple of state park bills, and there we have one bill, 2327, which looks like we can move it into 2208 as a, with an amendment. So State Parks has asked that we delay that until February 6th. And on Thursday, we will hear House Bill 2257, and we'll get our agenda changed to that effect as the maneuvering goes on. And this morning...
excuse me, sir. Did you say 2307 goes into 2208?
2257 will go to Thursday, yes. And this morning, both Thousand Friends and Oregonians in Actions have agreed to allow the American Planters Association to come forth first this morning to speak. So I will ask Stephen Cafori, I'll reopen our public hearing on House Bill 2137 and say good morning to our guests.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. I'm Stephen Cafori. I'm here today representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. I have Mitch Rose, our president, with us today. I appreciate the opportunity not only to speak in front of you this morning, but also to go first. Mr. Rose is a longtime planner in the state of Oregon and quite an expert. He has written literally a book on the history of land use planning in the state of Oregon, and we thought we might give you an overview. We appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chair, that this bill grants us. I think the issue of land use planning in the state of Oregon has always been a contentious one ever since, and we'll talk a little bit about the history of it. When Valley Measure 7 failed to become law because it passed but then was overturned by the Supreme Court, not on its individual merits of the issue, but because of the way it was written, we understand that the concerns that raised this bill in the first place are still around. We think that the bill, or excuse me, the measure as voted on by the people would have been a disaster, frankly, had it gone through. There's often such a difference between voting on a concept, which people do when they vote on initiatives, and voting on specific bills, which the legislature does. And having the opportunity for debate and discussion and amendment that goes on in the legislative process is, we think, the proper place for these kind of very technical, very complicated issues to be held. And we appreciate the opportunity to spend some time with this committee, and we understand that the chair is planning to spend some time not only with us but lots of other people, and that this is not going to be a quick, short process because it's a long, complicated issue. And we hope to begin that this morning from our point of view with some introduction to the issue of land use planning, some history and some background. And we notice that there are very few people that the chair has assigned and invited to speak this morning, giving us time to answer lots of questions, and we hope to spend most of our time doing that. Thank you. I'd like to introduce Mr. Mitch Rose, president of our association.
Good morning, Chair Girard, members of the committee. You'll notice that Stephen said I'd written the book. He didn't say anybody had read it. I was actually sort of hoping to follow Dave Honeycutt and Randy Tucker today, but perhaps it is more appropriate for us to sort of give you an overview of not so much of land use law, but of the what I'm calling the safety valves in my testimony today, the provisions in the law for regulatory relief. And that's how I'd like to present my testimony today. Basically, there are three points that we want to get across here. The first is that there are some very strong provisions in land use planning for protecting private property rights and values, and that indeed that's one of the fundamental reasons for having land use planning. And the second point that we want to make is simply that Oregon's strong land use planning laws have worked to the benefit of most owners. Landowners typically in Oregon have been the beneficiaries and not the victims of land use planning. And finally, we want to recognize that having said those things, that that doesn't mean that all is perfect. That doesn't mean that additional measures or better measures for regulatory relief cannot be adopted. And indeed, that's why we're here today. And we want to take a constructive role in that. And we'd like to very much be participants in the development of any kind of regulatory relief provisions, legislation in this session. And we hope we can bring some useful information and ideas to that kind of a process. The Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association is a small professional nonprofit group in Oregon. We have about 800 members statewide, a few in southern Washington. Most of them are professional planners. But I want you to take note that they work both sides of the counter. We have a lot of members who are local planners for cities and counties, but we also have a lot of members who work on the other side of the permit counter for private development interests. So we have a pretty broad base of opinion in our group about these things, and I hope that the comments that I'm going to make to you today will reflect that. To consider the first point, that one of the most important reasons for having land use laws is to protect private property rights and values, I'd like to just give you a brief historical overview of land use planning and land use laws. They're not anything recent. In fact, they go back to the early, colonial days of this country. And it wasn't unusual for villages in colonial times to have land use rules about certain types of development occurring in the village. And the typical rule was if you were a gunsmith, you couldn't work in the village. You had to be outside the village because, of course, they were concerned about fire hazards. And they had wood frame houses in the villages, and so they felt that there was a need to protect the private property in the village by making the gunsmiths stay out of town. And that's an early form of it. The laws in Oregon go back a century, and that's pretty typical of most states. Most states have had land use regulations on the books for the better part of a century. And in fact, one of the most important U.S. Supreme Court cases on that topic dates from 1926. It's the Village of Euclid versus Ambler. And that was a federal Supreme Court decision that declared that it was entirely appropriate for a village like Euclid to adopt zoning regulations which barred industrial uses in certain parts of the village. And the reason for doing that, of course, was to protect the private property and the private property rights of people who were already living in the village and particularly had residences there. Industrial uses right next to houses don't work very well, and the community wanted to do something about that, and the Supreme Court said, that's fine. In Oregon's case, land use regulations here go back about a century. I've been doing some consulting work for the city of Vail in Malheur County, and one of the interesting things I ran across there is that early in the century, they were having a building boom, and they adopted a requirement for every building in the Central Business District to be built of either stone or masonry. They were concerned that wood frame construction created a fire hazard. They didn't want that fire hazard downtown, and so in the interest of protecting private property in the Central Business District, they passed what frankly is a rather stringent law. For anybody who wanted to build downtown, they couldn't build a wood frame structure. In 1919, the legislature of this state adopted planning enabling legislation for cities. Basically said cities can zone land. And in fact, cities did zone land. Portland adopted a zoning ordinance in 1924. There were a great many other cities around the state that adopted zoning ordinances in the 20s and 30s. County enabling legislation came along a bit later. 1947 was when the counties were given the right by the legislature to adopt zoning ordinances. And by the early 60s, many of the counties had, well, I won't say many, some of the counties had adopted zoning, particularly for farmland protection, again, to protect the private property, the private property rights of farm owners, agricultural operators. So by the time you get to 1973, when our statewide planning laws were adopted in the now famous Senate Bill 100, what you find is a long history of land use regulation, and I think it's safe to say that Senate Bill 73 is
Senate Bill 100.
I'm sorry, Senate Bill 100 is so well known today because it was new, but because it pulled together what was already quite an array of land use laws. There were laws to protect the beaches, there were laws to protect farmland, there were laws to protect the Willamette River Greenway, and so on. Senate Bill 100 pulled those together into a coordinated system that was, in effect, a partnership between state government and local government. So these laws have been around for quite a long time. And with those laws, there also have been a variety of provisions for regulatory relief. These are what I call the safety valves. And much of the handout that I've given you today explains what those safety valves are. I'm not going to go through them in great detail. I've written a paragraph or two about each of them, and I don't think it's important that we discuss all the nuances of the safety valves. What I think is important is that you realize that that those safety valves are there, and that there are a variety of different ways to provide regulatory relief in the case when landowners have been given an unfair burden by regulation. When we get to the topic of unfair burdens, I think sometimes the process we have for dealing with legislation may give us kind of a distorted impression, because what we tend to hear is horror stories from people who have had an unfair burden imposed on them by the regulations. We tend not to hear many stories from the other side, landowners who in fact have benefited greatly from the planning system that we have. I can give you just a couple of personal anecdotes about the benefits of this system. I bought a house in West Salem in 1986 for $55,000. I sold it 8 years later in one open house, one weekend, for $110,000. So in 8 years, I doubled my money. Now, that house was in one of the most heavily regulated types of zones you can be in, a single-family residential zone. Very limited in what I could do with that property. But at the same time, having those regulations there to protect the quality of the neighborhood, to protect against the landfill, the dog kennel, the wrecking yard, whatever that could have been built down the street from me without those laws, that enhanced the value of my property. I was a winner from this land use system that we have, and I think many landowners have been. Sometimes you'll hear the complaint that the system works unfairly in the rural areas, that it's fine in the cities, but it doesn't do a very good job out in the country. Well, again, my personal experience with that has been pretty good. I'm one-third owner of an 1,800-acre cattle ranch over in Grant County. It's been in my family since the 1940s. My grandparents bought it in 1942, and they paid $4,500 for it. Today, the tax assessor tells us that it's worth $245,000. I suspect he's a bit low on that. But the point is, that ranch is in a heavily regulated zone. It was unzoned when my grandparents bought it. It eventually, in the 70s, went into exclusive farm use zoning. Later, the North Fork of the John Day River, which flows through it, went into the State Scenic Waterways Act. So it's in a heavily regulated zone. What's happened to it? Well, the value of the land has increased over 50 times in 50 years. So again, this doesn't suggest that the regulations are lowering property values. And in fact, as you'll find in here, I've got a bunch of statistics. I won't go into them. But if you look at land values in farm zones, which are readily available from the U.S. Census of Agriculture, you'll find that the value of farmland in Oregon has risen dramatically in the last several decades, at the very time that we imposed land use zoning in a lot of these rural areas for the first time. And not only has it risen dramatically, it's risen more in Oregon than it has in the neighboring states that don't have farmland protection programs as strong as Oregon's. So, point being, yes, there are some occasions when land use regulations work hardship on landowners, but for the great majority of landowners, they provide a strong benefit. As far as the safety valves, as I mentioned, I'm not going to go through them all in great detail, but I would like to mention just a couple of the more important ones. There's the right to appeal. Anyone who's denied a land use permit typically has a right to appeal to locally, typically to the city governing by city council or the board of county commissioners, and then take that appeal on up. In Oregon, we even have a special appeals body, the Land Use Board of Appeals, where all land use cases go, all land use appeals go. That can be taken on up to the Court of Appeals, ultimately to the State Supreme Court. So there's that avenue. We have variances. We have the principle of vesting. Once you've made a commitment to doing something on your property, invested a certain amount of money, time, and energy into a particular development proposal, you have the right to continue that, even if the laws change and become more restrictive. We have a variety of property tax abatement programs and provisions. There's farm value assessment. There's historical places deferment for that. There's a riparian zone deferment, which was adopted just last year by the legislature as a safety valve measure for those folks who are having to deal with some of the habitat protections that have recently come online. Here, this is an interesting one. I can't explain this, but for 20 years there was a provision in Oregon law, ORS 308, 341, which said if you've been downzoned or regulated in such a way as to greatly reduce the value of your property, you can get your property tax, you can have that amount removed from your property taxes for a period of up to 5 years. And as I say, that program was in effect for 20 years. It was, as far as I know, it was used very little. I know very few people who even know about it. And I don't know why that is. I don't know if it's simply that people didn't know about it. I don't know if there was some regulatory obstacle in using it. But it may well be that there just wasn't much need for it, too. But as I say, I'm not sure why it wasn't used much. There are other measures such as lot of record laws. We have stringent, well not stringent, we have, I would say fairly open lot of record laws which have been on the books since 1993. That's the second round of lot of record laws. We had some similar provisions adopted by the legislature in the early 80s. A lot of jurisdictions provide density bonuses to developers. If you're going to be restricted from developing over here, we'll let you develop additional density and higher density over here than what the ordinance would normally allow. So again, it's a compensatory provision for the burden of the regulation. And a couple of other safety valves are transfer of development rights and conservation easements. Those are used in quite a few places in Oregon. Transfer of development rights, the most notable use of that is in southern Deschutes County. If you're familiar with the Lapine area, there were thousands of small lots created in that area before the statewide planning program was adopted. And with that came a host of problems relating to water quality, water supply, access, and fire protection. And what it comes down to is there are a lot of folks in there with lots that they can't build on, because if they put more houses in there, those problems would only be exacerbated. So what the county did was adopt, among other things, provisions for transfer of development rights. And what that means in so many words is, okay, you can't build a house here, but we will give you, as compensation for that, the right to develop a house over here in what's called the receiving zone in another place. And I can't tell you much about the track record there. It's only been in effect for a few years, so I won't tell you that transfer of development rights is the solution for all problems, but it's an interesting alternative that is being used. It's also being used in Portland, I believe, to some extent. So there are a variety of safety valves out there. Having said that, as I mentioned, we do believe that there may indeed be a reason to have more of them or to extend some of these provisions. We do not believe that compensation is the only way to get there. And in fact, it strikes us that in many circumstances, compensation is the wrong safety valve. Your testimony last week from a number of people who were concerned about the imposition of land use regulations, the issues that they were talking about really didn't have much to do with money. And several of them said they weren't seeking compensation. Several of them weren't concerned about notice, for example. They were never told when the zoning changed on their property. Well, that doesn't get addressed by compensation. And so one of the things that we think is very important that we ask of this committee is make sure you consider the range of options that are available for regulatory relief. Don't land on compensation just because it's perhaps the best known of the regulatory relief measures as a result of things like Measure 7. I'm going to wrap up my remarks there. Just want to say a couple of closing things. First of all, we're very supportive of this committee's efforts to deal with this issue, and we would like to see a bill come out of this session that in fact does provide meaningful regulatory relief for those owners who have been hit with some kind of an undue burden. We're pretty skeptical about compensation, mind you, but we would certainly be pleased to see a bill that is both equitable and cost-effective come out of this committee. So we want to work with you to get there. To do that, we've given you a list of recommendations. This is attached in my testimony, 19 points about things that we would like to see in any kind of a bill dealing with compensation and regulatory relief. And we would certainly like to participate in any working group or work with this committee over the next few months to develop appropriate legislation. Finally, just a couple of notes about attachments to my testimony. You'll find a couple of things in there. One is just a description of what Senate Bill 100 said about compensation. There's an enduring myth about Senate Bill 100 that says that it required compensation, but nobody ever implemented that provision of the law. And as you'll see in the actual text of the bill is in there, the bill never required compensation. It required that the issue be studied. And in fact, it was studied by the Joint Legislative Committee on Land Use. And they issued a report, several reports over the course of the year saying that compensation for takings beyond what was already allowed under the state's constitution was not necessary.
Incidentally, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I was chairman of that committee in 1973.
And the other thing that's important about that is that the Senate bill talked about compensation for loss of use, not loss of value. And there are two pretty distinct features there. If you lose the use of your land, you're told that you can't do anything with it. That's compensable under current constitutional law, the Oregon Constitution and the federal Constitution. Loss of value, your property goes from $150,000 to $120,000, that is not loss of use, that is not a taking, and compensation for that kind of loss of value is a much different scheme. It's one that is certainly not in the Constitution now and is not widely used in any place that I know of. I only know of a couple of states that have made an attempt to go in that direction. The other thing I'd call your attention to is the there's a clipping, I think it's the very last page in my testimony, a clipping from a November news article that came out just a couple of weeks after the passage of Measure 7. It talks about what may have been the first claim that was filed under Measure 7 for compensation prior, of course, to the court's ruling that Measure 7 was unconstitutional. It was a claim from a sand and gravel company in Jackson County. And they asked for $50 million. Now, whether that was a legitimate claim, whether land use regulations had, in fact, devalued their land, cost them $50 million, I don't know. But I do know that when you sit down with your calculator and multiply that times 36, which is the number of counties in the state, if you had one claim of $50 million, from each of the 36 counties, never mind the cities, that takes you up to $1.8 billion. And I think the message or the lesson from that is that if you do get into the area of compensation, it's very important to write the bill in a tight manner so that you've defined very clearly what loss is. Because loss of value is a pretty slippery term, and it can be, to many people, it means loss of speculative value. Well, gee, my property's worth $100,000 today, but if I hadn't had that zoning on it, it would have been worth $1 million. And boy, that's a tough one to write legislation on. So you have a challenging task ahead of you, and we'll look forward to working with you on it. And I certainly would welcome any questions that you have.
Any questions from the committee?
I have one.
Representative Richardson.
Mitch, my question is, you have explained how successful this has been in your own life. You know, you have some personal experience with it. How would you feel if you were the property owner of 18 acres and were notified that there now was a zoning requirement that you can't build a house if you have less than 20 acres and you do not have the money to do to go through the appeal process and the variances? And just how do you think that you would feel as a person, as a citizen?
Chair Gerard, Representative Richardson, I think there's no doubt that I'd feel pretty bad about that. But it depends on the circumstances of the case very much, too. Suppose, for example, that 19 acres, and I think this is a pretty typical situation, suppose that 19 acres has been, maybe it was worth, maybe I paid $50,000 for it. And at the time I bought it, it had some farm value, and I've been farming it. I want to build a house there. That's my dream. That's what I want to do. And then I'm denied the right to do that. But value of the property stays at $50,000. Maybe it increases. Maybe it increases to $100,000. The tough question there is, what's the appropriate form of regulatory relief? Is it compensation? I don't think so. There's been no loss of value. So that's what a lot of record and some of these other things try to get at. And one of the interesting things about this is that there are a lot of provisions in the law for these types of safety valves. And I think one of the problems is just that landowners don't know much about them. I was working for the state a few years ago, and I retired in the year 2000, but at the time that I was working for the state, I came across a list of the property tax exemptions and relief programs and so on, and I've been working in planning since 1973, and I looked at this list, and there were things like tax relief for historic places and things like that. Long list, went on for page after page after page. I didn't know about 80% of those programs. They were complete news to me. I'd never heard of them. And I've been working in this for almost three decades. And I suspect that that's a pretty common problem, that, you know, a little bit of public outreach and education might help a lot. My apologies for such a long-winded answer.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Representative Green.
Thank you, sir. We heard a case that if the facts were as discussed from Deschutes County, it seemed that there was a possibly improper decision on the part of the county denying the right to build a house. And the folks said that they weren't willing to take it to Lou Burt and appeal because the added expense would be very large and also complicated and a variety of other things. Do you have some suggestions on how to make that appeal process simpler so that apparently improper decisions or decisions that a landowner felt were improper on the part of the county could be more easily redressed?
Chair Gerard, Representative Greenlake. Frankly, not off the top of my head. The local appeals process typically is a relatively low-cost sort of thing. I mean, if your planning commission denies your permit and you want to go on up to the city council or the board of commissioners, typically that's a few $100s in most areas. So that's not terribly expensive. It's hiring an attorney, if in fact you choose to do that, that gets expensive. LUBA is kind of the same way. You can go to LUBA and show up yourself and represent yourself for a few $100. So it's not terribly expensive. It's when you have to pay to hire an attorney, typically the legal costs are going to run into $5,000 to $10,000 to take a case up to LUBA, as I understand it. So I don't have any quick suggestions for that. I would mention one thing about that case, and which I was here for and did hear the testimony on. I think it would be real useful for the committee to get the staff report on these cases, because I know when I heard that testimony, I had a lot of questions, and I believe there were some other planners that talked to the people that presented the testimony after the hearing and asked them about certain alternatives that they may not have been aware of, that they may not have explored. Because I certainly, when I heard it, I wanted to learn more about some of the details, because a couple of things just didn't sound right about the county's decision on that. All of these things are public records. In all cases, the county or the city is going to write a staff report on it. It should be a pretty easy task to get those. And incidentally, regarding that, in 1982, there was a governor's task force appointed, which went around the state. I think we had 10 hearings. Stafford Hansel, whom some of you may have known, chaired that. Basically went around the state with the members of this task force, conducted public hearings, and did very much what you're doing today, and said, how's the program working? Are there problems that need to be addressed? Well, of course, people showed up with some problems. And I was a planning staff person for that task force, and one of my duties was to investigate these horror stories, if you want to call them that. And I hesitate to use that term, because sometimes if you say horror story, it makes it sound like you don't believe it's true. Well, in fact, I think most of the stories you hear from landowners coming up here and describing their experiences with permits are, in fact, true. I don't doubt them. I would call up the county or the city and say, well, we had testimony last Tuesday night from so-and-so saying they, wanted to do such-and-so with their land and they couldn't do it. And very often I would find that there are all kinds of extenuating circumstances involved. And the classic was a fellow testified that he'd owned this property for years, small piece of land over in eastern Oregon, couldn't build a house on it. County wouldn't let him build a house on it. And I could see the task force listening to this testimony and thinking, wow, that's pretty harsh. And I was thinking that was pretty harsh. And the guy giving the testimony was certainly sincere. So I checked it out a couple of days later, and I found out that the story was absolutely true. The county had denied him the right to build a house on his small lot because there was already a house there. He was looking for the right to build a second house on his property, and the zoning only allowed one dwelling to be built there. Well, he, in all good conscience, testified that this was too restrictive, but he never mentioned the fact that there was a house there already, and to him, he had a perfect right to have a second house. Well, you can argue the pros and cons of that, but the point is there was a big factor in there that wasn't conveyed in the testimony that the task force wouldn't have been aware of otherwise. So I'd just suggest getting staff reports on these if you can.
Mr. Rose, Mr. Kapori, thank you both for your testimony this morning.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
The committee recognizes that many in this room have heard these arguments before, but this committee has not, and obviously that is the purpose that we have invited testimony. And Randy, do you mind going first, or do we flip a coin?
I'm the second from. I think Dave also asked.
Well, let's bring them both up at the same time then.
Are you here?
Bring.
Okay. There's three of us, Mr. Chair.
Randy, do you mind being outnumbered?
I don't mind. I'll go now. I'll sit in the middle then.
Okay.
Oh, I have some stuff to hand up.
We do have a couple of individuals who have requested some public testimony at the conclusion of our invited testimony, and hopefully we'll have time to get through to that. So, good morning, Randy, and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, and members of the committee. My name, for the record, is Randy Tucker. I am the Legislative Affairs Director for 1,000 Friends of Oregon, and I believe you were all here a couple days ago when I told you about 1,000 Friends of Oregon, so I don't have to start there. As you know, 1,000 Friends of Oregon strongly opposed Measure 7. In November of 1999, we, along with the Oregon League of Conservation Voters, convened the first meeting of what ended up becoming the No on 2 and 7 committee, fighting Measures 2 and 7. I don't have the planning background and the longevity dealing with land use issues that Mr. Rose has, but I definitely have my hours in on Measure 7. I served as the primary spokesman for the opposition campaign, and I also served on the state's official Measure 7 explanatory committee that developed the explanatory statement for the voters' pamphlet. So for a good long time, my life has been all Measure 7 all the time, or at least it was, and this is how pitiful a creature I am. I actually have the text of Measure 7 in my Palm Pilot. That's really, it's really a sad commentary on my life. You won't be surprised to hear that 1,000 Friends of Oregon strongly opposes House Bill 2137 as it's written. In its current form, this bill would impose unknown, but in our view, probably pretty substantial costs on taxpayers. It would tie the hands of every local government in the state as they attempt to deal with future challenges, and it would also affect a massive rollback of the current laws and rules that protect our productive farm and forest land for resource use. When this bill was introduced last month, it made me think of one of my favorite quotes about politics that I've used many times. Politics is the art of looking for trouble, finding it whether it exists or not, diagnosing it incorrectly, and applying the wrong remedy. There's definitely issues out there that people have. I'm not sure that this would be the answer. I understand that for now, of course, this bill is mainly a vehicle for opening the discussion of these larger issues, and I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. In that light, I'd like to respectfully offer some comments and questions that go to the broader issues rather than to the specifics of the bill itself. And apologize in advance, it's hard for me to avoid being a little bit repetitive with things that other people have already said. Hey, welcome.
That's fine. Anybody got a camera? Could I take a picture of that?
You know, Mr. Chair, Representative Zahner, we had lunch together the other day. I mean, it's not, you know, we we get along fine. We just don't agree on that much. First of all, bringing forward House Bill 2137 on the rationale that the legislature needs to carry out the will of the voters as expressed in the passage of Measure 7 raises a whole set of complicated issues, as I'm sure you know. There is no sort of law of nature, no law of politics that requires that the legislature reconsider initiatives that are flawed and that are invalidated by the courts. And in fact, the legislature has a highly inconsistent record on that matter. In my own experience, I was the spokesman when I worked with Osberg for the campaign finance reform initiative, Measure 9, that was passed by nearly three-quarters of the voters in 1994. And, you know, that one has not been taken up again by the legislature in the intervening years since it was overturned. Regarding the intent of the voters in passing Measure 7 itself, the Attorney General attempted to interpret the measure, and it took him 110 pages, I believe, to say that he wasn't really sure exactly what it meant. And given how difficult the measure itself was to interpret, it's really difficult to interpret the voters' intent from the election results. I think Representative Williams said it best back right shortly after the measure passed in 2000 at a big conference where people, again, tried to figure this thing out. He said, "The voters clearly sent a message, but the message isn't clear." And I think that was a pretty good description of where we were left, what we were left with after the end of the election. I handed out a cartoon that I guess the audience doesn't get to see. With a couple of guys, there it is, sitting, I'll read it for you, sitting at the table reading the newspaper, and the first guy says, "Remember Measure 7? You know, the constitutional amendment to compensate property owners when government regulations reduce the value of their property? The one which would cost billions, destroy land use planning, and tie state and local governments in knots for decades, remember?" And the other guy says, "No." And the first guy says, "Me neither. Apparently we passed it." And I think that fairly accurately depicts the level of public interest and concern among a lot of the public about this topic. Obviously, that's not true for everyone, and we've heard testimony from people in your last hearing that care a lot about the outcome of this discussion. But even that testimony, I think several of those pieces of testimony illustrated that even people who do remember the measure and care a lot about it still don't necessarily understand how it really would have worked. I think several of the people who testified last week would not have had a claim, even if Measure 7 were in effect, because of the exception for federal law in the case of people in the gorge, properties that have not declined in value in a few of those cases, and the gentleman that was here concerned about access to his property across a highway would have had zero access to remedy under Measure 7. It is possible, I think, to interpret, to conclude certain things based on what the measure did not say, combined with what we know about Oregonians' attitudes about our land use laws. First of all, Measure 7 was not about weakening Oregon's nationally admired system of land use planning. Some people will have, of course, attempted to portray the passage of Measure 7 as a voter's repudiation of land use planning, but as was mentioned in the last hearing, the measure itself did not even mention land use. The ballot title doesn't mention land use, and that's what the voters actually saw on the ballot when they cast their votes. Neither the pro-Measure 7 campaign nor the opposition effort really focused on land use planning. The question of land use planning was not presented to the voters in the Measure 7, with Measure 7. And in this connection, I point to you to a short letter to the editor that I handed out to you this morning from Hector McPherson, who, as you know, was the Republican state senator in the 1970s and the chief sponsor of Senate Bill 100, who makes the point that I just made. Basically, the evidence that we have to this point indicates that Oregonians continue to support sound planning, as well as common sense environmental protections, which also would have been affected by Measure 7 itself. In poll after poll, the citizens of this state have said that they favor the laws that promote sensible growth management and protect our productive resource lands from urban and rural sprawl. And businesses continue to count Oregon's quality of life as one of our state's competitive advantages. So given the wording of the measure and its variety of impacts, to say that it was about land use is a selective claim that we believe is not really supported by the evidence. With this in mind, we were pleased last session to see the instructions from the Speaker of the House to Representative Williams' committee, the Land Use and Regulatory Fairness Committee, that those instructions included the following statement. Recognizing that Oregonians have consistently supported a comprehensive land use system, the focus of this work is not to overhaul the current land use system. And I would argue that this committee should follow this guideline as well. More specifically, the voters did not call for rolling back existing protections if they might lead to claims for payment. Again, nothing in the measure's text or ballot title suggests that it was about repealing or waiving the regulations that protect our farm and forest land from development, that help to stop wasteful sprawl, and that make our communities more livable. Throughout, the focus was on paying landowners, not releasing them from compliance with the law. And there was polling that was done after the election that reaffirmed this distinction. By about a 9-to-1 margin, voters rejected the idea that of responding to the measure by waiving the regulations in question to avoid payments. Instead, they said, we meant what we said, compensation, cash money. I think it's pretty clear that Measure 7 itself was about compensation. Nevertheless, as you've already heard from several people, a lot of people don't want compensation. People that came before you last week all uniformly said that was not what they had in mind. Unfortunately, then they're not looking at Measure 7 as the vehicle for relief, because in our view, the plain text and the ballot title of the measure are very clear about what it's about. Using Measure 7 to justify weakening or changing the laws that protect our quality of life would substitute a very different agenda from the one that was placed before the voters. Let me just make comments different from what you've got in your, some same, some different from what you've got in the written testimony up there. First of all, you heard some very good testimony, I think, from Linda Ludwig of the League of Cities the other day, and also from Art. slack of the Association of Oregon Counties about the question of whether a remedy in the future should be prospective or retrospective. I have concern about instituting any kind of a compensation requirement that is prospective in nature. That really ties the hands of local governments from now until the end of time. If you have some sort of forward-going compensation requirement having to do with new regulations, no one can predict the kinds of issues that are likely to come before local governments and our local communities in the future. We'll have challenges related to population growth, new technologies. Just for example, 20 years ago, no one foresaw the sprouting of cell towers all over the landscape and the kinds of regulations that have had to be instituted to govern where those can be placed. There are other unforeseen changes that we want to be able to respond to in the future. So unless the voters decide to offer up a whole lot more of their tax dollars for compensation for complying with any new or reinterpreted regulations, we're effectively robbing our communities of the ability to respond to the challenges of the future. On the issue of notification, it was mentioned the other day, and I believe Chair Gerard, you also mentioned that as well. But the voters passed Measure 56 in 1998 to provide notice of upcoming land use actions that could limit the uses of property. What very few people realize that since at least the late 80s, there has been something in the statutes that I handed out to you, Oregon Revised Statutes 93.040, which has required every real estate transaction to include a warning that the property is subject to land use laws and regulations, which in farm and forest zones may not authorize the construction or siting of a residence. So people that have purchased properties since this language went into effect, which was well over a decade ago, have been served this notice at the closing of their transaction. And I know that that's not necessarily everything that we would want, but it certainly it's something that people have been given. Mr. Rose mentioned farm value assessment. I think it's important to remember that while development potential is limited in our farm zones, there's also a concomitant reduction in the tax burden that is applied to land in the exclusive farm use zones. Land that's zoned for farm use is also taxed at a rate not based on its value for development, but on its value for farm use. And in fact, I believe there are people that know more about this than myself. It's taxed below the value that it holds for farm use. There's some research going on right now that is not concluded, but a preliminary estimate is that there have been, you know, well into the billions of dollars of tax relief provided to owners of land in exclusive farm use zones since the land use laws went into effect. There are several comments related to compensation that you'll see in the written testimony that I'm going to just skip for now. Based on how we would calculate it, fairness to people whose property values may be affected by neighboring development rather than by a lack of a development opportunity for themselves, and that sort of thing. And if we do go in the direction of talking about compensation, I think we ought to be, you know, many of these questions have been raised, and I assume we'll have an opportunity to discuss them. Just like to say that we are committed to participating constructively in the search for appropriate responses to Measure 7. We're also committed to thinking, if you will, thinking outside the Pandora's box that Measure 7 is, in the effort to find ways to address the legitimate issues of fairness while still protecting the livability of our state. There may be solutions to the concerns that have been raised before this issue and that were raised by Measure 7 that are different from House Bill 2137, and that they don't look like a warmed over or revised version of Measure 7 itself, but they provide other means for getting at these fundamental fairness issues, and we look forward to exploring these possibilities with you. And it's important that we think more broadly about the issue of fairness when we have this discussion. Fairness does include fairness to people who have been unduly burdened by regulations, and especially those who have suffered a disproportionate impact. But it also includes fairness to property owners who may see their land significantly devalued if a restriction on a neighboring property is lifted or from a lack of restriction on a neighboring property. It includes fairness to communities, as I said, that are grappling with concerns about traffic and sprawl and quality of life from now and into the future. And it also concerns, it includes fairness to the taxpayers who will be dealing with whatever decision we make. I'd like to just conclude with a couple of thoughts from others. First of all, there was a very important decision of the U.S. Supreme Court last year, sometime last spring, the Tahoe case. I don't remember that it was like Tahoe blah 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 versus Tahoe blah blah blah. You know, I don't remember the the exact you know, who v who it was. In the Tahoe case, Justice Stevens wrote that to require taxpayers to pay for all land use regulations that affect property values in any way, quote, would transform government regulation into a luxury few governments could afford. He then went on to quote Justice Holmes from the famous Pennsylvania coal case, 1922, who said that government could hardly go on if, to some extent, values incident to property could not be diminished without paying for every such change in the general law. The court's ruling really demonstrated the understanding that zoning and planning and sensible regulation ultimately work to protect and enhance property values overall. The Tahoe case concerned a temporary moratorium on development to protect the water quality of Lake Tahoe. And certainly that was something that would protect property values around the lake. And as in that case, regulations that protect our quality of life make our communities more desirable and thereby enhance the value of our real estate investments. In other words, protecting the public good also protects property rights. The court's ruling also quoted from the 1987 Keystone Bituminous Coal decision, another famous decision in the takings area, that said that while each of us is burdened somewhat by such restrictions, we in turn greatly benefit from the restrictions that are placed on others. And one more way of putting it, from a very compelling speech by a guy who describes himself as a crass, unrepentant, real estate, capitalist, Republican type, and unapologetic about it. That's a quote from him, a guy named Donovan Ripkema. He says that land use controls are a capitalist plot to optimize the property values of the majority of owners. And so I leave you with that thought, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'd be glad to answer any questions, and I look forward to working with you on this issue as the session develops.
Randy, if it's all right with you and Dave, I'll wait and hold the questions till both of you have completed your presentation. I do want to mention, though, because I think it is important, that this committee has no political agenda to move or not to move this bill. We brought this bill forward at this time because, A, we knew it was complicated. We wanted to take our time. If it takes 3 months or 6 months, we wanted to take the necessary time to find the right answers and to do the right thing, and to resolve an issue that we believe has been left unresolved by court action. So that's our motivation on this committee. Mr. Honeycutt, good morning.
Good morning, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of House Bill 2137 and more generally in support of some type of measure that would compensate or allow the people who you've heard appear in front of your committee to actually make some type of reasonable use on their property. We call her the poster child for Measure 7. She's 90 years old, so she's probably not doesn't fall within the definition of a child. But she's Dorothy English is sitting back there, and what I had hoped, Mr. Chair, is that I could bring her up and have her tell a little bit about her story. If you
please do, it's your time.
Okay. Well,
I'm glad to move back into the
come on up
front row here or whatever.
Thank you, Randy.
For sure.
This lady is 90 years old.
Yeah, this is Dorothy English. Hello. We'll let Dorothy tell her story, but Dorothy is 90 years old. It's my favorite 90-year-old. She doesn't outrank my grandmother. My grandmother's 95, so...
I don't want to outrank your grandmother.
What I thought I'd do, Mr. Chair, to sort of structure our presentation, Ross Day has handed out, our Director of Legal Affairs, has handed out both our testimony, our written testimony, and also a copy of a CLE of materials that I prepared for two CLE continuing legal education classes that I taught on the takings issue. As Randy indicated, I think he and I have been around the block on this for quite some time, and of course my interest goes far beyond Measure 7, and as a matter of fact, I hadn't really planned on talking a whole lot about Measure 7 simply because Measure 7 isn't the law and the courts invalidated it. It's gone, and so I hadn't planned on wasting the committee's time talking about Measure 7 other than to tell you I disagree with Randy's reading of the poll numbers. Matter of fact, as I recall from the last session, the governor's original intent on Measure 7 was just simply to let it go on the theory that the voters didn't know what they were voting on, and that opinion changed based on some polling that the governor or somebody, you know, one of the opponents to Measure 7 undertook that showed, number one, that the voters knew exactly what they were voting for, and number two, that if given the opportunity, they'd vote for it again. I disagree with that, with the idea that the voters didn't know what they were voting for, particularly given the fact that there was a $2 million campaign to defeat the measure, and about 300,000 or 400,000, I can't remember exactly how much the yes on seven folks spent, but it was a little bit more than it was significantly lower than what the proponents or what the opponents spent. And so, if you know, running a $2 million campaign, that's certainly adequate in this state, having been involved in campaigns, that's certainly adequate in this state to get a message out. But rather than talking about that, what I thought I'd do was simply tell the court a little bit about the takings remedy now, the remedy that we actually have that's in the law, both at the federal level and at the state level, and how that doesn't work, and why some type of additional measure is needed to protect the rights of Dorothy English and all of the folks that you've heard testify. I've sat in my office. I've had hundreds of clients sitting across my desk at my office with the exact same stories that you've been hearing, hundreds. I'm not talking about 10 or 15. And I've had to tell these people over and over and over again about the potential remedies that they have. And typically, what typically ends up is that I have folks that walk out of my office disappointed and sometimes in tears because there is essentially nothing that I can do to remedy their problem. We have a takings clause under the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution. We have a takings clause under Article 1, Section 18 of the Oregon Constitution, part of the Bill of Rights. The problem is the courts have interpreted the takings clause, and let's just start with the Oregon Constitution. The courts have interpreted the takings clause of the Oregon Constitution to not require compensation as long as a property owner has some substantial beneficial use. That's the buzz phrase, some substantial beneficial use. And so somebody comes into my office and says, okay, I own this piece of property. I've got a $100,000 mortgage on it. I'm paying my mortgage payments every month. I went in to apply for something, and all of a sudden the county or the city or somebody tells me that I can't do that. Do I have a claim? And now the value, and I say, well, what's the remainder value of their property? And most people don't know, so we go back and we try and figure it out. And let's say it's $50,000. So that essentially their $100,000 piece of property has been devalued by half. Would they have a claim under Oregon's takings clause? And the answer is no. the courts have interpreted Oregon's takings clause in that some substantial beneficial use phrase to essentially mean that you have to lose nearly all of the value of your property. Now, you don't have to lose it all, but nearly all. So we have a case like Dodd versus Hood River County, where the Dodds lost 70% of the value of their property, and the Oregon court said, well, you didn't lose, you still have some substantial beneficial use of your property, and so we're going to deny your claim. They lost 70% of the value of their property. It's akin, and it would be like this committee saying, well, we're going to pass a law that makes it a felony to speak out against the government, but we're going to allow you to speak out against the government on 30% of the days of the year, and the other 70 if you speak out against the government, it's a felony. We'd all jump up and down and say that violates our free speech rights, and yet we allow, or we have courts interpreting the Oregon Constitution to say, well, the takings clause allows a government to come in and steal at least 70, or to regulate at least 70% of the value of your property, and so your $100,000 piece of property is now only worth 30. You've still got to make your mortgage payments, and you don't have any claim at all. Now, that's not the worst of it, however, because even if I find a client who I think has lost all substantial beneficial use of the property, and so they would have a takings claim, we still have what's called the ripeness doctrine. And what the ripeness doctrine requires is that we submit at least one and usually multiple applications for both rezones and the different uses allowed in a zone. So a zone may have 20 different uses, and in order for my clients to even have their day in court, even get into the courthouse to find out if they have a claim, we would have to submit at least one use and probably multiple uses. The reason I don't know exactly how many is because the courts, the Oregon appellate courts and the federal appellate courts, are more than happy to tell you when a case isn't ripe, but they won't tell you what you need to do to ripen your case. So you just have to guess. And so you have situations like the Del Monte Dunes case down in California that went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, where the developer went in and said, "Okay, I want to build 500 units," and the city said, "Well, we won't approve 500, but if you come in and apply for 450, we'll go ahead and give you that one." So they went in and changed their application and applied for 450, and the city said, "Well, we won't approve 450, but if you do, you know, 350, we'll approve that." And so they went in and did 350, and you get the pattern. After I think it was either three or four unsuccessful attempts where the city continued to ratchet them down, they finally went in and applied for a taking, and the court said, "Well, I guess you've done enough at this point to ripen your claim." So I've got somebody like Dorothy sitting across the desk from me, and I'm telling her, number one, we've got to show that you've lost, we've got to show that you've lost almost all the value of your property, and then number two, we have to apply it probably for a zone change, and at least one or two of the uses in her case in the forest zone, so maybe a graveyard, that's a use in the forest zone, a cemetery, or a dwelling, or a partition or something, and we have to, and I can't guarantee to you, Dorothy, that after we apply for those and pay those application fees, which you're not allowed to recover, you don't get your application fees back, after we hire your experts, pay your application fees, submit these applications, I can't guarantee that when we go into the courtroom that you won't get dismissed when the Multnomah County files a motion to dismiss your case on the grounds that it's not right. I can't tell you that the court will even entertain your case." And so what you have is situations where people in these positions, and in the positions of every single person that you've heard in front of this committee, essentially have no remedy. The takings clause is no remedy at all in this state, and frankly under the federal constitution either, in situations where you have a regulation imposed on a particular piece of property that devalues the property. And so obviously, whether it's Measure 7, whether it's something along the lines of 2137, whatever it is, there needs to be some type of remedy for this situation, so that people that have legitimate claims, and there are many people in this state that have legitimate takings claims, the people that have those legitimate claims have the ability to actually get those cases resolved, and don't just have to go out and pay their mortgage every month and pay property taxes for the privilege of having open space, which is exactly the situation that we have now. With that, I'll turn it over to Dorothy, and then I'll make some closing remarks and some suggestions on what we, at least we at Oregonians in Action, would like to see that direction taken for this committee.
Good morning,
Thank
Dorothy.
You. Thank you very much for listening. In 1953, my husband and I bought 40 acres of view property. It had no water, no outside, no inside plumbing, an old house, but we were used to hard work. We were poor. No one handed us anything. So we rolled up our sleeves and started putting in a water system and getting ready to build a new house to live in, which we did. In 1970, the house was complete. So we decided to survey our best view property, 20 acres, and have it so that we could give our grandkids a home site when they grew up. And if we needed or wanted to sell one, we could. So we had them surveyed, 6 3-acre parcels and 1 2. Along came LCDC. Now, they scared people with the idea that, well, you don't want someone to build a slaughterhouse alongside of you. Well, guess what? I've had neighbors I would rather had a slaughterhouse alongside me. Now, along came the new rules with LCDC. Now, I'll tell you what I think LCDC is. It's poor man's eminent domain. They take complete control of your property and don't pay you a damn dime. Now, the other part is increase in value in your property. What does that do? Raises your taxes. How does it help me? My taxes now are close to $5,000 a year. Now, the other part is I will not go on forest or farm deferral or old people's farm deferral. I pay my full share of taxes, and we always have. Now, to me, it doesn't help one bit that the value of my property, sure, it's great. What am I supposed to do with it? I can't sell an inch of it. I can't even let my grandkids build another house on 20 acres. And I'm 3/4 of a mile from the city limits. Now, this is disgraceful. Is this the America I grew up in? I don't think it is. Now, we fought and tried to change. We could not believe those laws affected us. They came in, said to us, oh, well, that 20 acres you surveyed off and what your plans were, oh, no, that's no good. From now on, your 20 acres is 3 parcels, including the one your house is on. We spent thousands of dollars on lawyers trying to fight it. Finally gave up. Now, we sold 11 acres to one man so he'd have access to his other property. 11 later on, 9 later on to another one. And they have us zoned as CFU, commercial forest. That's a joke. and wildlife habitat. You know what wildlife, people that live in apartments and think all animals are Bambi. Well, guess what they do to your property? You can't have fruit trees. You can't have a garden. This year, deer came and ate every rosebud and leaf off my roses right against the house. Now, this ballyhoo that the animals, oh, they don't want houses up there in the, where the trees are because it scares them. Like hell it does, we had 32 elk in our front yard and eating our flowers and looking in our window at it. Now, you tell me how afraid they are. Now, I am 90, and I'm damn glad of it, and I intend to live to be 100, because there's a lot of bastards I want to get even with. Thank you.
You finished, Dorothy?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Forgive us, Dorothy, we weren't quite sure. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. Come on, Dave. Let me, yeah, I don't like to follow Dorothy ever, but I'm going
to
follow up.
Pretty tough to do.
This time. It is true. We talked, the cities and counties and the department, you know, they all, everybody talks about funding source, and I appreciate that. I appreciate that argument, and I understand what they're talking about, but I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for them, because right now you're looking at the funding source. K. Finney is the funding source. The Preddies are the funding source. The idea that these regulations are free is silly. All of these regulations have an economic impact. To the extent that Dorothy has 20 acres that can't be forested, and we've had commercial foresters out there that say it's too small to be forested, and it's too steeply sloped, and yet it's in a forest zone, a lot of these problems, frankly, would be solved if we'd actually take a good hard look at what really constitutes farmland and what really constitutes forest land in this state, and protect the land that is really farm and forest land, and allow people to make alternative uses on the land that isn't. We can have that that debate for another day, but the fact is that right now, while we've got Dorothy's land in the commercial forest zone, the value of her land is she's got a home on it, but the value of the remaining portion of her land is virtually nil. It's almost nothing, and so she's the one that's paying the cost for the land use planning system. Kay Finney's the one that's paying the cost for the land use planning system, and the Preddies. So the funding source, I appreciate the funding source argument, but the idea that the taxpayer should get a free pass, and why we expect a select few of our own Oregonians to pay the cost for all of these things that supposedly provide benefits to all of us strikes me as being very unfair, and it's something that we ought to remedy. If the land use system is as beneficial to all of us as my friends claim it is, then the public as a whole ought to be willing to share in the cost of that, rather than expecting Dorothy English and a few of her friends to pay for the open space that supposedly benefits us all. That's what whether you phrase it in terms of a compensation measure, or whether we actually look at take a more whole scale look at our land use planning system and try and fix the problem where you have 97% of all your privately owned land outside of cities in farm and forest zones, whether we actually take a look at what's really farmland and whether we fix some of the problems within the urban growth boundaries, it matters to us only for the reason that most of our members, including Dorothy, if you asked her, and I'll speak for her, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Dorothy, would rather have the ability to use their land. You've heard that over and over, and that's a common theme. I hear that over and over as well. They'd rather have the ability to use their land. They don't want a check. But at the same time, you know, if in the alternative compensation is provided, you're not creating a new obligation on the government. All you're simply doing is spreading that burden more equitably amongst the taxpayers in this state. So we'll certainly open to either source, although most of our members would certainly prefer to have the ability to use their land, or at least give the local government the option, if they so choose, after looking at a particular fact pattern. All these cases come up on different fact patterns, to look at that pattern and say, look, rather than compensating here, we'd rather, it makes more sense to allow these people to use their land, which is certainly the case for Dorothy.
I would like to say something else. Typical women, they always have something else to say. Number one, I would like someone to tell me what good it has done the state of Oregon to steal my property, and that's what they've done. I would like someone to explain to me what good it has done for the state. It has done absolutely nothing for me or my family. And I'm a native Oregonian. I was born in Oregon. I've lived here all my life. Thank you.
So, we're more than happy to participate on a work group. Obviously, our interests are towards protecting people like Dorothy. That's what they were with Measure 7. That's what they were during the last session and all the meetings that I sat in with Representative Williams and then Representative Schrader. We're certainly willing to go through that process again. But we would urge the committee to look not just at a compensation measure, but also at a more comprehensive solution to fix problems like Dorothy's.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Dorothy. If someone like to escort Dorothy back, and I'll ask Randy to come back up, and we'll go into a question and answer period. Looks like Dorothy's very capable all by herself.
I wouldn't want to play a racquetball up there.
She'd probably beat you, Cliff.
Yeah.
All right, we'll open the committee up now to questions. Representative Dorothy.
Thank you. The comments that were made earlier about just the way that land has been valued and the benefits, I guess, that the farmers have had in having a lower tax based on being an EFU zone property. I guess, can you both maybe discuss whether there are similar impacts when inside an urban growth boundary, there has been over-regulation that has actually impacted the value of the property. Are the tax assessors taking that into account when they value the property so that they, too, are getting a lower tax rate? Or are they still paying for the, as if there was no damage or no damage to the value of the property with that regulation in place? And then kind of follow up, if you can, with some discussion on, whether there was discussion about this issue last session, that those people that if a Measure 7 type of compensation plan did come into effect, was there any balance in these landowners that all of a sudden would they get a windfall, if they were allowed to develop the property, say they've gone 30 years now paying the lower tax, does there any kind of balance, I guess, in coming back that they actually have to pay back? Or, somehow get a, I guess, almost recompensate, for the less amount that they've had to pay in taxes. Does that make sense?
Yeah. You want to start or do you want me to start?
I don't actually know the answer. I know part.
Let me do it in reverse order. As I understand your last question, Representative Doyle, it was whether or not we talked in the work sessions last session about some type of solution if somebody was entitled to compensation and actually received compensation, whether they'd have to go back and pay back taxes or essentially pay the penalty to recoup for their tax deferral that they were on if they were in a farm or forest zone. We did talk about that, and I can't remember the conclusion that we reached, but I think there was essential agreement that the sort of the 10-year, the current 10-year look back provisions would be applicable or could be applicable. I don't think there was anybody arguing that that wasn't to be the case. I'd have certain philosophical issues with that. Essentially, the farm tax deferral, what the state received in farm tax deferral, in exchange for the farm tax deferral, is the all of the limitations on uses that can be made on that property. And so that's an annual, every year that you're limited in what you can do with your property, to the extent that you receive some type of modest farm tax deferral. I think the state's getting a real bargain, and so why they'd make you go back 10 years and pay more taxes for the bargain that they're already receiving strikes me as being unfair. But on the other hand, there was general agreement that would be something that would be in a package if something came out of that group.
Well, and before you go, Randy, I'm just on the, I guess, inside the UGB. Has there been any analysis, I guess, on how appraisers are valuing land that's basically overregulated?
Chair Garrard, Representative Doyle, there wasn't any discussion that I recall in the work group about that. My only experience, and here this is anecdotal, of course, but my only experience working on those issues, I've had a few clients where we've done that. The City of Portland, for example, adopts an environmental overlay zone that essentially makes a lot undevelopable. And until you go and actually initiate the process with the county, with the tax property tax office at the county, your taxes will remain the same. There's a disconnect between the regulatory section of either a local city government or a county government and the tax assessor's office. And so until you actually initiate that process yourself, those things don't happen. I've seen it done on a couple of occasions, both of which were successful.
Mr. Chair, Representative Doyle, I don't have a lot to add to that. Yeah, my understanding of the current tax system is that if you're inside a UGB and there's a restriction that suppresses or causes your property value to be lower than it otherwise would be, that you are not taxed at the higher value. You'd be taxed, at least theoretically, at the actual lower value. But it may well be that there is that disconnect between, you know, new regulations and changing the valuation. Certainly we would not argue that that shouldn't be fixed. I mean, people should not be taxed at a value that is not the actual value of their land, at least a higher value.
Okay. And one last follow-up, and Ms. Tronica, you might be able to help me with this. Randy cited the Supreme Court case, and I wasn't sure, was it Tahoe blah blah or Tahoe
Tahoe Sierra Preservation Council versus Tahoe Regional Planning Authority or something like that.
I think you got it right. I think that is the actual.
I did look at it this morning, but
the holding of that, Mr. Chair, Representative Doyle, the holding of that case is essentially that a 36-month moratorium, a planning moratorium, that acts where for a 36-month period of time, the dissent argued it was 60 months, but regardless, 36, 60, whatever it was, during that period of time, and in the Tahoe region on certain properties, there was a complete, absolute moratorium on any type of development at all. And the landowners in that case went in and said that at least for that 3-year period of time, you've taken all value of my property and I'm entitled to be compensated. And what the Supreme Court held is because that moratorium was only for 36 months, on the facts, particular facts of that case, you didn't have a total taking. That was the holding of that case.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Doyle, there was language in the opinion that I didn't bring, unfortunately, I could provide to you, that went to the core of the Measure 7 question, which is this idea of partial takings. And basically, the court rejected the idea that if you're of partial takings, whether by in a temporal sense, as in the Tahoe case where there was a moratorium, in the spatial sense where there's a limitation on the use of a part of a property, or in the sense of use where there's limitation on some uses but not on others. The court said that in those cases you have not reached the constitutional threshold for what's called a taking.
Representative?
Mr. Chair, I wonder if either of you could help me with this term, reasonable investment-backed expectations. Does that have standing in common law or statute or...
You're a lawyer.
And what does it mean?
Chair Garrard, Representative Greenlick, reasonable investment-backed expectation comes from a United States Supreme Court partial takings case, Penn Central Transportation Company, I think, versus City of New York. You'll see it cited. I'm not giving you the exact correct site, but you'll see it cited throughout the CLE materials that I presented. And essentially, there's a three-prong test under the Federal Takings Clause. There's a three-prong test to determine whether a regulation has resulted in a taking, and one of those prongs is the impact that it has on the reasonable investment-backed expectations of the property owner. And so what reasonable investment-backed expectations are is a case is really on dependent on a case-by-case analysis. And so what you do is you go back and you try and figure out at the time the owner purchased the property, number one, is there any evidence about what their intentions were at the time they purchased it? How was the property marketed? What were they proposing to do? What was the zoning ordinance in effect at the time? Would the zoning ordinance in effect at the time allowed them to make that use? Essentially, you're trying to figure out what they were trying to do. Was that dependent on the price that they paid for the property? And then were those expectations that they had reasonable? And like I say, there isn't any. You can't go to Black's Law Dictionary and find a definition for it. You just have to do, it's sort of like the substantial beneficial use test under the Oregon Takings Clause. You go back and look at other cases and try and analogize based on the facts of the two cases to figure out, to make your argument.
Does it look like a duck?
Exactly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I'm not sure if I've said this explicitly, but I'm not an attorney, so you can discount anything I say on this matter. But I'll speak anyway. my limited understanding of at least the past state of the law is that if you haven't applied for or actually made some sort of an effort to use your land in certain ways, you don't own the right necessarily to do that. And Dave may clarify this for me, but there is past case law anyway that I am familiar with to that effect. So that probably, flows into this idea of reasonable investment-backed expectations. That may be changing right now with, I don't know, the Palazzolo case, which is one of the more confusing cases with about 17 different opinions from the U.S. Supreme Court about a year and a half ago or something like that. And I was hoping to actually find out, to do some homework on that before I appeared today. I wasn't able to reach the people I needed to reach.
Thank you, sir. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask both of you, where you think the most fruitful places for us to look for potential consensus in this area are. Clearly, the testimony that we've had at previous hearings would indicate that some of the people who feel like they've been wronged by the current system aren't really looking for monetary compensation. And clearly, local and state governments aren't in a position to come up with millions or billions of dollars, even if that were what they were asking for. So I guess, since both of you went through lengthy negotiations last session on this topic, I'd appreciate it if you could tell us where you think the points of agreement were most apparent, where would be a good starting place for us to look at something that could provide a balancing for people who feel like they've been ill-served and yet maybe keep in mind some of the protections that have benefited the state of Oregon.
Well, Chair Garrard, Representative Rosenbaum, I will say that I was actually not involved in those negotiations myself. My colleague, our former executive director, Robert Liberty, was the main person that participated. So I wasn't in the room for those discussions. I think the place to start is with the concept of fairness, which I think both sides agree is what this is really about, and trying to determine in what cases do we really agree that there's a problem. As Mr. Rose said earlier, often when cases are presented or brought forward, when you ask a few more questions, you find out some more facts. In the last session, there was a lady who came to the legislature with great concern about being unable to build on a piece of property, and it turned out that she owned the piece of property next door and lived in a house right there, similar to the case that Mr. Rose mentioned. You know, I think we need to figure out where somebody is affected sort of disproportionately, unduly, singularly, and those are the kinds of cases that obviously we agree we'd like to take a look at. I think starting from the concept of some sort of a blanket compensation right or a large-scale rollback of the protections in Oregon's land use laws is not the best place to start.
Now, Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, the bill that you have in front of you, 2137, is I believe fairly close to sort of the working draft that the committee had last session, and so over the course of the negotiations last session, this bill represents a fairly close proximity, and obviously there are some things in 2137 that we'd like to see change. But from our perspective, when the solving the retroactive claim, solving the situation for people like Dorothy English and the folks that have testified is every bit as important as doing something prospectively with a compensation claim to make sure that the system is from henceforward is treats people more fairly. We're obviously interested in that angle as well, but solving that, as I said before, if we do a prospective piece only, where we only deal with regulations that are adopted in the future, that doesn't help. Essentially, it provides no assistance to anybody that's testified in front of this committee or to anybody in the rural areas. The rural regulations in this state have been set. Well, the $80,000 rule was sort of the last big change, real substantial change, and that was done in 1994. And so if we do something that's only prospective, it doesn't provide any relief to the people that you've heard. And so what we'd like to see is sort of a two-pronged approach where we look at the rural or where we look at the retroactive, you know, the past claims, and if we want to limit that to rural issues, that would be, you know, we could certainly live with that, and then a prospective piece that I think encompasses both rural and urban.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, if I can follow up on Dave's answer. I think I earlier expressed my concern about the prospective piece of this. And it's worth pointing out, and I also would differ with Dave about whether the $80,000 test, so-called, is necessarily the problem we've disagreed for a long time.
Since 1994.
That's right. Even though I've only had this job since 1998. it's worth pointing out, and to the extent that you hear bills on this matter, you'll have plenty of time to dig into this. But in the early 1990s, was the most recent time, I think Mitch Rose also mentioned, that a lot of record provisions were changed. A lot of record seems to be the big bone of contention where people owned property before regulation changed. And there was a really significant effort to balance the interests of individuals with the broader public interest in 1993 in a bill called House Bill 3661, where a lot of record provisions were developed for people that owned property before a given date, basically grandfathering many of them in to giving them the ability to build a house. That was balanced against the public's interest in protecting farmland from development, and so not every property was given that right. And I believe the breakdown, Dave might know better than I, is based on high value versus non-high value farmland in that case. In many other cases, you know, we're looking at a balancing of the public interest and the private interest that that our current regulatory system attempts to achieve through, you know, at the local level, the city level, the county level, and at the state level through you know, the stuff that goes on every day in government. And our concern, of course, with the Measure 7 type approach was that it basically discounted the very notion of a public interest in regulating. And as soon as there was any kind of an impact on a property value, the property right took precedence in all cases. And obviously we'd seek a more balanced approach than that in whatever comes out of this process.
Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We realize you've been through this a lot and repeatedly, but we appreciate your...
Thank you.
We have six people who would like to speak to the committee this morning. We have approximately 20 minutes, which would give each person about 3 minutes. If your testimony would take longer than 3 minutes, we'll certainly continue this public hearing until Thursday to give you an opportunity to give your full testimony. So when I call your name, if you cannot do the 3 minutes and are available on Thursday, we'll put you down for Thursday. And we're going, first of all, to the people who are the furthest away. So Buzz Ortiz?
I would respectfully request to be on the phone first.
Thank you very much, Buzz. Appreciate that. Bob Looper. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Gerard, members of this committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Bob Looper, Troutdale, Oregon. I am not against House Bill 2137. But I would hope it could be revised to better solve the problems of our land use system, a land use system so out of control it has devastated Oregon's economy, driven businesses from the state, divided the state, ravaged people's dreams and lives, resulted in increased congestion and degradation of our roads, and added to the lack of integrity and credibility via our land use planning process. The issue is fairness. It is not a partisan issue. It is not about saving farmland or saving our natural resources. The issue is fairness. I live in the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area. I also own 24 acres zoned EFU in Marion County that I bought in March 1985. Before buying the property, I checked with county planners and told it was an illegal buildable lot, but I did need to submit a farm management plan. That was no problem to me since I wanted the half-wooded, half-cultivated property to build a single house and farm the open area. After the purchase, I had the property surveyed, made arrangements for power service, and began the process preparing for a building permit. I won't go into some detail about what happened, suffice to say that Marion County Planning Chief Planner got into court and said that I didn't have a buildable lot. The jury ruled in my favor and said otherwise, and awarded me damages for the damage that was done to my property. Later, I find out Marion County Planning records are so screwed up that the Planning Department thinks my property is contiguous with a separately owned parcel down the road, and also lost my legal description even though they claim to have been able to do an analysis of the lot line adjustment application without it. Then the $80,000 rule comes along and shuts me out unless I want to commute. While I already had a tractor and some equipment, it would mean that I would also have to purchase a truck and trailer to commute or purchase another secure property to store the equipment closer. If I have to commute, then I can't be competitive with a farmer that doesn't have to commute. The present system just eliminates competition and future farmers from getting started. Small family farms are proven to produce more and a greater variety of farm products per acre than larger corporate farms. Many of the smaller farms are not even counted in coming up with the $80,000 rule. Commuting only adds unnecessary traffic to our roads and adds more pollution to our air. I want my right to build a home on my property returned to me. One of the tactics of the Measure 7 opponents and supporters of the present system is to blow enough smoke so that people cannot tell what the real issue is. The issue is fairness. You cannot achieve fairness without addressing the integrity and credibility of those land use planners administering the system. Please refer to my written submittal for examples of out-of-control planners. Opponents claim no funding source is identified for compensation. Here's my solution to compensation expenses. As an architect, I am licensed by the state. If you don't like what I do, you can rip my license. Lawyers, real estate agents, building contractors, even building code plan examiners, and some farmers are required to be licensed, registered, or certified by the state, but not land use planners. The public cannot trust a bureaucrat who is incompetent, doesn't tell the truth, or claims he is above the law everyone else is supposed to follow. My suggestion is to license land use planners and LCDC planners. Use the same logic and procedures as the planners at LCDC for determining what a reasonable license fee would be. $80,000 per year sounds about right. Here's your chance to tap an untapped revenue source, and let me be the first to volunteer to be on that board. 250 planners would put $20 million in the state coffers. Please don't make a Texan out of more Oregonians. There is no reason to penalize good stewards of the land. Thank you very much.
Any questions of Mr. Leppert? Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Paul Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paul Phillips. I'm with PacWest Communications. Many times you see me before you on behalf of the construction industry or labor unions or industrial users. Today I'm representing Metro, the voter-created regional government in the Portland metropolitan area. This agency is charged with coordinating many of the activities and managing the important services in the metro area, including land use planning, transportation, solid waste, running the zoo, convention center, and expo center, and working with our local partners and regional parks and open spaces. This government agency serves 1.3 million people and has 24 cities within its jurisdiction. Metro is governed by a six-member elected council. They're elected by district and a council president. This is different than what some of you may recall from past years when I testified in front of you on behalf of Metro. Previously, we had an executive that was elected and a council that was elected. Voter-approved system changed that. I appreciate the committee's willingness to delve into this issue. Last session, we worked very closely with Max Williams and his committee on the issue. Consensus could not be reached, but that does not mean this is an issue that we shouldn't continue working on. The bill before you, House Bill 2137, has some inherent problems. I understand that that bill probably won't come out as it's written, but I'd like to raise to you some concerns about the bill. We are worried about the bill because it might cause some unintentional problems in the metro area with regard to adequate land supply for industrial purposes. Two members of this committee, Chair Garrard and Representative Rosenbaum, were in front of a different committee when we talked about one of the most vexing economic development needs that the state has, and it's available industrial land. This bill causes us some concern in that area. Metro Council recently voted to add more than 18,000 acres of land within the region's urban growth boundary. The council specifically added acreage in Washington County in response to concerns that the county was running out of large, contiguous sites for high tech. Under the draft that you have in front of you, a decision by local government to zone a particular site, and I've cited two, Chute Road and Evergreen Parkway, such as these are 200-acre sites, for a specific purpose could be interpreted as a taking under the bill. In such case, then, the local government would be powerless to prevent the parcel from becoming a strip mall, a big box retailer, whatever else it might be, without compensating the owner of the property. I can't believe the drafters of the bill actually wanted to prevent the identification and siting of large tracts of industrial lands. So those types of things need to be fixed. The second issue on a quick read of the bill that shows up is that it interferes with the ability of cities to make specific zoning changes in response to public pressure, in this case a ballot measure that passed in the metro area this May. If the city of Tigard decided to enact zoning regulations to allow only low-density housing in a single-family neighborhood, they might be subject to these taking provisions. Again, I can't imagine the drafters of the bill took that into consideration. This bill includes authority to regulate non-residential cases, but it does not cover other forms of residential uses. The bill needs much more clarity in this area. The third issue, again, is one of those that I don't believe the drafters really would have meant to do if they would have been aware of it. It is possible that the bill might unintentionally hamper the ability of governments to prohibit developments in areas prone to landslides. Now, obviously, that wasn't the intent of the drafters, but that's actually what the bill could be. These are initial reflections on the bill. This is clearly a difficult issue, and the most difficult issue involving this is the compensation and whether revenue would come if indeed it was decided that compensation is an issue that needs to be dealt with this session in this bill. I would urge the committee to focus on working on to implement a more reasonable approaches that can be termed as victories, but clearly the passage of Ballot Measure 7 and the controversy that swirled around this bill since I've been around this building it indicates that there is a true issue that needs to be addressed. To answer, Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum's question of where you might start, we suggest solving the lots of record issue, or at least starting on that issue alone, would be an excellent starting place. We understand from the Chair that there will be a work group or a number of work groups set up to study this issue. We offer our participation and willingness to work cooperatively to solve this issue. I wouldn't be the appropriate person or my staff, but Metro Attorney Dan Cooper, who has been involved in this for a long time and sat through all the work groups last time, would be an excellent technical resource to assist you. We look forward to working with the committee, and thank you for the time, and I just barely beat your 3 minutes.
Just barely.
Just barely.
Any questions? Representative Doyle.
Thank you. To your first point, Mr. Phillips, on the example of the Washington County expansion of the BGB, or of their commercial developed land, if that's turning into commercial land and it was EFU zone prior, how is there a taking that you would have to compensate the farm owner for giving him a higher value property?
Well, that would, Mr. Chair, Representative, is actually setting aside industrial lands. And we don't on the surface, we don't believe they intended that to be a taking. But if you read the bill, it could be interpreted as a taking. It could be interpreted as they didn't want it to be cited as industrial, set aside for industrial zoning, and had some other intention. So that's just an area of clarification, Representative Doyle, that needs to be addressed, because on the surface you would assume that people wouldn't claim a takings. But without clarity, there's always somebody willing to challenge something in land use planning. Thank
Seeing
you.
No other questions. Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Now we've got four people left with 7 minutes, so you're now down to 2 minutes apiece. Roger Kay.
Good morning, Chair Guard, other members of the House Environment and Land Use Committee. I was going to say you saved the best for last, but I'm not last, so I'll try to do my best here. I'm a member of the Marion County Planning Commission, but I am not representing them at this time before you. But I do have some comments on this bill, and I've outlined 6 points which are very disturbing to me, and I wish you'd take note of these. And I'd also like to volunteer my services when your committee does set up a working group to try to address some of the issues raised today and the last few meetings of your committee. I oppose HB 2137. because a 10% reduction is much too low of a standard. This threshold should be raised to 25%. Appraisers often differ in their property valuation by 10% or more, and the Marion County Board of Equalization denied a reduction in my own property tax because appraisal was within 10% of the tax assessment, so 10% is too low a threshold. Point two, I also oppose the bill because no differences are made of the accounting of land and building valuation in this bill. Marion County dramatically changed its valuation procedure by placing higher valuations on land and reducing valuations on building, whereas they kept the total valuation constant. So this is a factor. I also oppose the bill because land valuations usually increase with time. Land valuations chosen for compensation should be taken at the time of acquisition and not 10 or 20 years later. Point four, no consideration is given to land use changes over time. Property owners can't expect a stagnant developing environment. Applicants could be given a period of 2 years from the time the property purchase is made for which land use is locked in. For example, the City of Salem Public Works Department requires renewal of building permits every 6 months if no periodic inspections occur. Number five, there cannot be a successful future prediction of land use. Supersiding by state, county, and city agencies of roads and highways, government buildings, landfills, water, wastewater treatment facilities, power plants, gravel pits, and prisons will cause property valuation changes in the local environment. And last, large private sector developments often require government land use regulation changes. Givings and takings are therefore unpredictable and may cause local governments to shoulder compensation actually caused by private sector development and permitted by variance or other land use decision. And in point six, I suggest perhaps the committee should look at the possibility of setting up a givings-takings bank, whereas all those people that acquire increased valuation on their property will be considered givings to the bank, and those people that lose valuation because of the development could be considered takings, and people who are given should give to people who have been taken from. And this is a way that the government can stay out of the process, and people who are given and people who are taken can fight amongst themselves for it. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to deliver these comments, and I urge you to reject this bill, HB 2137, as written.
Any questions of Mr. K? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We have Brad Witt, Jim Walsh, and Ralph Groner yet to speak. Do any of them wish to come back on Thursday? Thank you. So who does that leave?
Did Jim raise his hand?
Leaves Jim. Okay. Jim, you'll wrap it up. You got, well, you got 3 minutes.
Chair Girard and members of the committee, I'm representing Oregon State Grange, a 19,000-member fraternal organization that supported ballot measure 7. And we certainly support the basic concepts within this bill, House Bill 2131, and we are very pleased that you have initiated it so early in the process to begin discussion, because we know how long it took last session and how much argument there was around this issue. Well, we also certainly support is that there should be compensation for takings, but we really think what's important is that there is a regulatory relief involved here. We'd much rather be able to do on our property that which we'd like to do, and that includes a dwelling. But we also know in land use planning in the state of Oregon that more and more pancaking of regulation is taking our ability away. We are very concerned about the pioneer opportunities that brought us, our forefathers, all the way over to the West Coast, that we're losing those opportunities to be able to do on our property as we hope to. We think there's certainly a intended or unintended force in this country to move us all into urban areas. and protecting forest and farm, yes, it's important, but there's a need to have small and large farms, and there's room to do that. If we, in our organization, we realize that we are a very diverse population, and if we're going to respect diversity, then we should be able to respect the fact that there's plenty of people that would like to have 5, 10, 20, 40 acre lots out there also. Something we're losing, a concept we're losing in this country that was very important early on, is the fact that small building blocks of property are the building blocks of wealth in this country. Without those, our young people in the future will not be able to build wealth. And without that wealth, we won't have the money, honestly, to support government in this country. It can't be all the large farms, can't be all corporate farms. The fact is, the small sections, 5, 10, 20 acres, they're very important. I know my son was able to buy 3 acres. He'll build wealth with this. He could. Many of us, we even have 5 acres, my wife and I. Have you tried to put a garden in and maybe raise 30% of the cost of your food items in a year on those lots that you see in suburban Oregon today? You can't do it. It's very important that we keep an eye on the agrarian values within this country, or we will lose our wealth, and the government will be dictating to us continuously how we will share our wealth if we have any left. Another issue we want to bring forward and we support in our policy is identifying secondary lands. These are lands that are less than high value farmland and forest land. Honestly, lands that should be identified by the county so we could establish new communities, establish blocks of acreage that we could use and we could build on. And a lot of us could see that pioneer dream, that dream to build wealth in this country is so important to us. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate this opportunity. We would like to be part of the work group, too, Oregon State Grange.
I apologize for not recognizing your past membership of this legislative body, so excuse me.
That's all right. That was passed.
Any questions of Mr. Wells? Seeing none, thank you, Jim, for your testimony. And it is 10:31. Nice job. And we shall adjourn this meeting until Thursday. Oh.